This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens.
Larry Charles has been involved with some of the biggest comedy projects of the last 30 years. As a writer for Seinfeld, he was known for coming up with many of the sitcom's darkest moments, as well as developing the iconic Kramer character. As a director, he's worked behind the camera on Curb Your Enthusiasm with former Seinfeld colleague Larry David, on the Sacha Baron Cohen guerrilla-style comedies Borat and Bruno, and the documentary Religious with Bill Maher. Clearly, the man has a keen eye for the funny and absurd, which has led him to his latest project, Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy, on Netflix. This docuseries explores the varying definitions of comedy in different cultures around the world, from Russia, Iran, and Nigeria to the American heartland. On this episode of How Success Happens, we discover what comedy guru Larry Charles has learned about the vital importance of laughter. But first, a word from our sponsor. If you have a business or you know someone who does, you probably know that small business owners wear a lot of hats. And some of those hats are totally great. But some, like filing taxes and running payroll, for example, not so great. That's where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and expert HR support all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes so you don't have to worry about it. Plus, they make it easy to add on health benefits and even 401ks for your team. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. So let them wear one of your many hats. You have better things to do. Listeners get 3 months free when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see for yourself at gusto.com/HSH. That's gusto.com/HSH. Now for our second sponsor. This episode of How Success Happens is brought to you by Shaper. Shaper is the number one business networking platform that helps you meet the right people to help grow your business. Are you looking for investors, a co-founder, a new job opportunity, or just inspiring conversations? Shaper will find people with similar goals by combining your self-selected interests, location, and industry to produce daily suggestions of relevant professionals you may want to meet. When both people say yes to a connection, the app allows you to message and set up a time to meet. Get Shaper and improve your networking game. Download the app today or check out their site at shaper.co. That's Shaper, SHAPR.CO. You won't regret it. I just wanted to kind of jump right in because I'll have to admit that I am a Seinfeld super fan. And I just wanted to kind of kick things off with asking, what was it like in that writer's room on Seinfeld?
Well, I think one of the biggest revelations I could share with you is there was no writer's room on Seinfeld. And I think that's one of the biggest differences between Seinfeld and the vast majority of other sitcoms. We didn't have a writer's room. We didn't have that many writers to begin with to even have a writer's room. The first couple of years, it was just a small group of people. And we might sit and talk about ideas, and then one person would go off and write a draft, and then they would be given over to Larry and Jerry, and they would do their pass, and that was the script. There was no group sessions. There was no punch-ups. We didn't do stuff like that. We kind of just trusted our own vision, our own idiosyncrasy. And by doing that, by having more singular voices really make the show, it didn't sound or feel or unfold like most traditional sitcoms.
Very interesting. You know, I feel like I read somewhere that maybe The Sopranos had a similar style to that, where it was less of a collaborative thing and more like, okay, we kind of come up with this general stuff, but then the writer goes home, writes it up, you know, David Chase sees it or whatever. That's interesting.
Yeah, we had come out, Larry and I had come out of sketch writing, where that's often how it was done. You went off and you wrote your own sketches, and then you came back and maybe on the floor as you were rehearsing it, whatever, and that happened on Seinfeld too, things would change and evolve. But basically, it was only a couple of voices really making the tone and the sensibility of what Seinfeld became. Now, later after I left, they may have done a writer's room in those last few seasons, but I don't really know.
Gotcha. Now, and were you involved as a writer in the whole process, like actually, you know, being on set in terms of when they were shooting the show? Were there kind of last minute punch-ups or things like that that you'd be involved in?
I would say during my, I think I was on the show for like 80 episodes. And I would say that every episode of those 80 episodes, I was in every casting session. I was on the floor for every rehearsal. And I was also in editing with Larry the vast majority of the time as well. So, yes, I was very deeply involved in the entire production of the show. Again, coming out of sketches where you're sort of responsible for producing your own sketch, I learned at a young age, just inadvertently, about all those things. And so I had strong opinions about camera angles and delivery of lines and things like that. And Larry allowed me to hang with him through all that process and give him my thoughts, and those thoughts were, you know, reflective in the show.
Now, when you guys, when you and Larry, or when you started on Seinfeld, I know his background as well to some degree wasn't really from the sitcom world, right? You're at the sketch world, and so was there a bit of like a learning curve there for both of you, or has he, you know, say anything about his own perspective on that?
The learning curve was for everybody else. Like, we went into that show. Larry David said to me, we'll do 13 episodes. It'll get canceled. We'll make a couple of bucks and we'll move on. So we went into that show with complete abandon and just wrote what we wanted to write. We knew it had to be a certain semi-length. But beyond that, we didn't have any rules for ourselves. We didn't know the rules and we didn't really care about the rules. And we started kind of making up what we would like to see in a show like this. And I think the people that were really surprised, the learning curve was for the production people who were like, you can't do 30 scenes in a sitcom. And we would say, well, why not? You know, and that kind of stuff really expanded the language, the visual language and the verbal language and the tone and the themes of what a sitcom could be.
Interesting, interesting. So I know that you worked with Larry David and also Michael Richards on the sketch show Friday. How did you get involved with that originally? And did you know Larry before that, or is that where you guys had met?
Well, as it turns out, we're from the same neighborhood. But I didn't meet him in Brooklyn or in stand-up comedy. I met him on Fridays. And the way I got to Fridays, the quick version is I came out to California and didn't know how to break into show business. And it's the late 70s, and I would write jokes. And I mean, no computer, no typewriter, handwrite jokes, and go out with a legal paper full of jokes, a piece of paper full of jokes, and stand in front of the Comedy Store and try to sell them. Wow. And it happened in the late 70s. That was like a golden era for comedy in Los Angeles and at the Comedy Store. Richard Pryor was trying out his act. Robin Williams was there. Letterman and Leno were battling to be the kings of the Comedy Store. And there was a lot of comedians hovering around. I started selling jokes and became known as somebody who had good jokes. And one of those guys got cast on the TV show Fridays and recommended.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's like obviously a totally different era. How did you first get into comedy? When did you realize that this was something that you wanted to pursue professionally?
Well, my father was a failed comedian, and so he had used the GI Bill to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. He acted, he did stand up, but it didn't really lead anywhere. He had a pseudonym that he used on stage, Psycho, the exotic neurotic. That was actually one of his stage names, and so you can imagine it didn't really go that well. But he, in our house growing up, he was on constantly. And so he was doing shtick and he was doing jokes and he was, you know, sucking you into his routines. And so I was immersed in that. You know, I was very immersed in his performance, you know. And then from there, also what was available on the three channels in New York at that time, there was a lot of comedy. There was Abbott and Costello, there was the Three Stooges, there was Popeye, there were all the things that all of us, Jerry, Larry, myself, all those things were on in reruns, really, and they were super funny. Sergeant Bilko, Car 54, Where Are You? And they were just readily available, and there was no computers or internet or any other distractions, and so that was it. You were kind of consuming that fare almost constantly, and, you know, it has to have some sort of effect on you. The other thing was growing up in Brooklyn. I grew up in a very rough neighborhood, and in order to get myself to extricate myself from dangerous situations, I had to learn some verbal skills. And that's also a place where humor sort of came into play, making people laugh, taking the edge off of things, diffusing situations, wound up being a survival tool also.
Oh, yeah. We're talking a little bit about Dangerous World of Comedy, because that seems super relevant to that, some of the people that you profile on that show. But absolutely, it's definitely a common theme. So you went to college and then you dropped out to pursue comedy, or how did that
go? I went to high school in Florida. My parents broke up and I finished high school in Florida and I finished early. But I didn't know anything about college. I wasn't even thinking about college. And, you know, I didn't have anybody in my life saying, what do you want to do with your life, you know? So I was kind of cast out on my own. And I hadn't seen my father for a few years. And so I thought, I'll go to college close to where he is. And he was in New Jersey at the time. And so I applied to Rutgers, and I got in. And I spent a year at Rutgers, which was fine. But it was like a brutal winter. And my father moved back to Brooklyn almost as soon as I got there. So it was like the whole thing became kind of pointless to me. And I dropped out for a year. And I had a friend named Adam Leslie, who was a stand-up in Florida. At 16, he was already headlining shows in Florida. And he got a gig with a band, being the opening act for a band, like a lounge band, that was traveling around the South. And he called me out of the blue and said, hey, why don't you come down and we'll be like a comedy team and we'll travel, you know, on the road. So I said, of course. And I joined him, and we wore foam green tuxedos and played Ramada Inns. And we took his act and we made it into a double act. And I did that for quite a while. So when I came out of that, I needed to do something else. I applied to NYU Film School, thinking that's the right thing. That's the sort of appropriate thing to do. But after a semester, I didn't want to be in school anymore. And so I thought I was going to go out to California. And that's what I did. I just drove out to California and got a job as a parking valet. And when I wasn't working, I would stand in front of the Comedy Store.
Wow, that's quite a journey. Now, during this time or post-Fridays, I know you did work on Arsenio Hall, right?
Yes, I did.
And how was that? Were there difficulties or things that you might have learned from in that experience?
Yes, that was all, and it hasn't been written much about, and maybe it is worth somebody writing something about it. Maybe I'll do it even. Because it was a fascinating episode, at least in my life, and I think I'm sure for Arsenio and the audience and everybody, it was really kind of a groundbreaking thing that had all the horrible repercussions that you can imagine. He was a black host of a show. That was unprecedented. So much so, and in those days, again, you're pre-internet still. If a white woman came on as a guest and he shook her hand, if Arsenio shook a white woman's hand to greet her when she came on the show, the switchboard would immediately light up.
Oh my God.
It was crazy the amount of hate that he got. I used to read, again, this is pre-internet, so we used to actually get hate mail, like with stamps on it, you know.
Wow.
I would read that hate mail, and it was vicious, man. It was racist. It was just some of the most vicious, ugly stuff I'd ever read. He was going on every night knowing that there was this whole contingent of audience that not only hated him, loathed him, wanted him dead. It was incredible pressure on him. So after a while, by the way, we had to have metal screeners at the studio. So when people came in and they would be – frisked, and they would have knives and weapons and stuff. So it was a very tense scene in a lot of ways, even though he managed to make it seem all easy and party-like.
Yeah, he sure did.
There was a lot of tension there. And for myself, he had hired me because I wrote very edgy jokes. And so at first he was loving it, but very quickly, as I said, it became so controversial just for him to be on stage that he started to back away from the more controversial humor and started relying on much easier, you know, cheaper type jokes.
Right.
And I got to a point where I didn't get a joke on for like 6 months. I knew I was going to get fired. And that was sort of the end of that. I had this crazy Jack Nicholson sighting that kind of was like a harbinger of what I was supposed to do. He was on the lot where the Arsenio show was being done, and he was doing the two Jakes at that time. And he was quintessential Jack Nicholson at that time, the coolest guy in the world.
Uh-huh.
And I hadn't had a joke on in 6 months, and I would stand outside the trailer, and I would be like lost, really. I was about to have a baby. I didn't know what to do, really. Like, what if I lose this job? What am I going to do? And at that moment, he came, Jack Nicholson, it was a Mercedes kind of cruising up to me. And inside was Jack Nicholson, and he had the Lakers cap on, the sunglasses. And he looked at me, and I was lost, and I looked at him. And for no reason at all, we both burst out laughing. And he said, yeah, it's funny. And then he just drove on. And I thought, yeah, it's funny. It's all absurd. It's all ridiculous. It'll be okay, you know. And I got fired. And the next day I got an interview with Keenan Ivory Wayans for In Living Color. And I was all excited, and I ran into that interview, and Keenan Ivory Wayans stood me up. And I was, in those days, I had, you know, I was kind of temperamental. And I kind of lost my temper. I stormed out of the office. And when I got home, Larry David was calling me to ask me to come work on Seinfeld. And the next day, Keenan Ivory Wayans called me and said, hey, I'm sorry, man. We had a mix-up. And I said, hey, I already took another job. So that's how fate works sometimes.
Wow. Now, skipping forward a bit, what kind of was the impetus for your moving from more writing into directing?
Well, I had wanted to be a director for a long time, even from the time I was a kid, really. But when you grow up in Brooklyn, you don't say things like, I want to be a director.
Right.
It's an absurd comment, you know? So I kept it to myself, and I thought, man, I don't have the technical know-how. I don't have anything to make me a director, really, you know? And you can't just make a movie, you know? But writing, you only need a pencil and a paper to write, you know? And I liked writing, too. I was very into writing. I liked both. But I liked directing as kind of as a viewer. But I liked writing. I liked writing stories. I was a cartoonist in school, and I enjoyed those skills. And I would read about, like, Woody Allen, for instance, who in the 60s and 70s, when I was growing up, he was kind of a god of Jewish American comedy. He was from my neighborhood. We had the same birthday. He had made Take the Money and Run and Bananas, which I thought were brilliant. And he started out as a writer, mm-hmm. writing jokes, and eventually kind of parlayed that into directing his own movies. And I thought, well, that's a path, you know, maybe that I could take. So I started writing the jokes. I would send jokes out to people from Brooklyn before I got to Florida, and send jokes out from Florida when I got there. And I would try to perform, and, you know, I just started to kind of build up an accumulation of stuff.
No, send out jokes, you mean via mail?
Yeah, I would submit like cartoons, I would submit
okay.
jokes. There was a lot of freelance writing opportunities at that time. Like, all the magazines were still very popular, you know? And so they all accepted contributions, you know? And I wound up, my first published article was in Screw Magazine, actually. So I got kind of successful as a porno humor person, you know? And that was really my first published stuff.
Oh, that's great. Now, what's interesting about your directing, especially thinking about things like Curb Your Enthusiasm or the work you've done with Sacha Baron Cohen, is even though it's fiction-y, I mean, it is fiction, it's very documentary style. Do you think that's just sort of the aesthetic that you naturally gravitate towards, or what's kind of the, you think is the, you know, thinking behind that?
I think there's a lot of things that go into my directing style. Because I'm a big fan of Kubrick and, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky. I love beautiful cinematography, but I've just never really worked on anything that really required that. And I also am very conscious, in contrast to that, to the economics and the realities of the filmmaking. I'm troubled by expensive movies. I'm troubled by the squandering of money. I'm troubled by the waste, really. And I love the idea of stripping everything down. And a lot of, as I grew older and became an adult, the filmmakers that I really admired, whether it was Godard or, you know, whoever it was, Frederick Weissman, Werner Herzog, they seemed to really get to the essence of what it was, a purity to that cinema that was left to chance, left you to discover things. So there wasn't as much planning. There was also more surprise. And that surprise, I'm trying to bring that surprise to the screen for the audience to feel. And for me, the way to do that was to strip everything away and be as raw as possible and as urgent as possible with the filmmaking style.
In terms of the dangerous world of comedy, I feel like there's definitely a predecessor there in terms of almost like the guerrilla style that you had to employ when directing Borat and Bruno, because, I mean, there's just so much, it's just so real, and the running and the hiding from the people and shocking people, and you having to kind of, you must have had to act yourself. I mean, when you went around with Sacha Baron Cohen, did you like, okay, well, I am the one filming this Borat guy? Like, how did that work, really?
That is kind of a version of it. I mean, I had a nom de plume. I used a different name. When I would meet the target, so to speak, I would explain that my crew and I were just a small freelance crew that was hired for the day to take this Kazakhstani journalist around. And I don't know much about him. I don't know much about Kazakhstan. I know that he's never been to America. I know that he knows nothing about America. He's not very good with the language. He might say something that might offend you. Don't be offended. Be patient with him. And people were very moved by that and believed that. And so that's how we would set up the environment for Sacha to finally come into.
That's really interesting. So it's more like you were like a real, you kind of portrayed yourself as like a day player, like a freelancer, not that you were really even traveling much around with this guy. So it's like, hey, you know, we have this little production company. They hired me. And interesting.
Yeah, that worked very well. And still being able to manipulate the scenes and, you know, take care of all the business and everything. And a lot of times I would say to people, look, if anything goes wrong, just, you know, I'll be right on the other side of it. I'll be in the other room. Just yell out Larry, and I'll take care of it. And then we'd start the scene, and I would leave.
Wow.
And so they'd start yelling out, Larry, Larry. But I wasn't there. I was there. I was hiding somewhere else. But I suddenly wasn't there, and now they were stuck in the scene with Borat, you know.
Now, when you guys were, like, really on location shooting everything, I mean, it just looks all so real. I mean, were there actually points when you had to be like, okay, stop, this is a joke? I mean, obviously you didn't, right? It's just, you just ran with the, rolled with the punches.
We never, ever, in either of those two movies, ever stopped and said, we're just kidding around, or it's just a joke, or it's just a movie. Never. We never did that. We never let go of the idea that this was real. Very much like Trump, you know?
Yeah.
We forced this alternative reality on people till they weren't sure what was real or not, you know. But we never said, oh, we're just kidding. No, it's a prank. No, no. This is candy cane. No, nothing like that. Nothing like that.
And did he, I was going to ask, did he stay in character? I mean, I know he stayed in character with the subjects, but like, was it one of these things where it's like, even when you're kind of done shooting, he stayed like that? Or is he, did he suddenly become that kind of like posh Cambridge educated, you know, gentleman that you see when he's not Borat?
Well, I think, it was such a different acting exercise than the traditional acting exercise. I mean, I felt like he should have been nominated for an Academy Award because he's coming out of the hotel room in the morning in character, ready to go. He is wearing Borat's underwear and socks, and he's got the stuff that Borat would have in his pockets. I mean, he was immersed in that character. When we would argue on in a location, he and I, which happened occasionally, he would argue with me as Borat. So he was Borat all day long with everybody until we finally wrapped. And we worked 6 days. We shot for 6 days, and we never shot for less than 12, 14, 16, sometimes more hours a day. And he'd have to be Borat through that whole thing. And sometimes in the middle of it, when we were all tired, his accent might start to slip or something, and I would have to kind of prop him back up again, you know. But basically, he was in character all day. So when we finally wrapped, he was able to finally break character. Similar to the Dangerous World of Comedy in the sense that although I'm not pranking anybody or trying to trick anybody, there was an urgency to it, and we had to be ready to pivot at any time and be ready for anything because we're only going to have one shot at doing most of these things. And that was the urgency of Borat, too. If we don't get it right here, we have to go to a whole other city and do it all over again, set the whole thing up all over again. So there was a lot of pressure on getting it right. There were no second takes. And it's the same thing with Dangerous World of Comedy. If you're in Somalia or Liberia, you're not doing repeated takes of things. You're getting what you get. And you're going to get it once, and you better be ready for it. And that's the kind of filmmaking that I really enjoy.
So where did the idea come from for A Dangerous World of Comedy?
Well, it came from a lot of different places. I mean, I have traveled a lot. I did a global Pringles campaign and all these, you know, weird movies and stuff. And I found that in all the countries I went to, no matter how oppressive the regimes were, there was always a comedy scene. And I thought, well, that's, you know, I get to come home and they have to stay. What's it like to be a comedian in an oppressive regime in a country that has a religious rule or a totalitarian government? How do they survive? And I thought that was interesting. And then I also was thinking, you know, what do people, you know, in these crazy places, these dangerous places, like, what do they laugh at? You know, like, what is, like, a criminal laugh at, or a soldier laugh at, or a terrorist laugh at, you know? And I became curious with that thought, too. And so I just started to research it on my own. I put in, like, the most dangerous places in the world in comedy. And no matter what place I put in, I kept upping the ante. Somalia, Iraq, Syria, there were always comedians there, you know? And I thought, this is, like, I don't think anybody's really tapped this, and I think I'm uniquely qualified to bring the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's not easy stuff to watch. Was it a challenge convincing Netflix that this was a project that was, you know, worth them doing?
I think they saw the appeal of it immediately, and even saw, like, the deeper appeal of it immediately. Maybe more so than I even did. I was just fascinated with the subject, but they were also enticed by it enough to say, okay, yes, they were concerned at times about certain aspects, talking to the warlord and things like that. But I think they saw in the balance of it when the shows were done that there was emotion, there was humor, there was politics, there was commentary, there was humanity. There was a lot of interesting, there was an interesting mix of unusual elements, which is what I like to do also. I like to juxtapose unusual elements to see if that synthesis will create comedy. And I think they were very supportive almost all the way through. They were extremely supportive.
Did you and your crew get into any hairy situations while you were filming?
Yes, not in the Borat sense of, like, confrontations and things like that. It was more, you know, we were in Iraq going to visit an ISIS prisoner in a prison in Kirkuk the day that Mosul fell, and there was kind of chaos in the streets on that day, and I was like, wow, we had to wear, like, helmets and bulletproof vests and be in an armored car that day. And so when you're doing that, you're becoming aware of your mortality. And then I guess the place I was most scared was Somalia. Mogadishu, because Mogadishu is just rubble. And, you know, there's a lot of people in camo with machine guns, and they're all in different color camo. You don't know who's who. And if you got stuck at a checkpoint or whatever, that's when bombs go off. That's when shooting starts. And so I told the crew, we have to be lucky for 3 days. All the security in the world is not going to save us. We just have to be lucky for 3 days, and we were.
How large is the crew that you were traveling with?
Very small. Also, again, taking this cue from First Curb, then the Sasha movies and the stuff that I've done on my own, Religious especially, I had one cameraman, one sound man, two producers. That's it, and myself. So we stayed very small, which allowed us access to a lot of places. We were very, very small footprint. We were very anonymous. It did not require people to really, you know, make a space for us. We could just go anywhere and start to shoot. And that's how I like to do it. I like to tell the cameraman to just put the camera and start shooting, you know. I don't even know what we're shooting yet, but let's start shooting, you know. And this allowed us to sort of have that method. So I was able to really accrue a lot of footage that way too, which I like to do as well.
And it probably helped keep your subjects maybe a little bit more at ease that it wasn't this like big slick Hollywood production. It's like, no, I'm just this guy who's curious about this. Tell me, like, what is it like? What's the truth about it all?
Right. That's exactly right. It really helped put people at ease and make them talk with great intimacy about their experiences.
And, you know, just in terms of like common themes from the show, you know, the idea that bad things make good comedy. Is that something you believe?
I do. I mean, there's a great expression from the 50s or 60s about comedy being tragedy plus time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Lenny Bruce, you know, was doing JFK routines just after JFK was assassinated, which, you know, raised these issues of, like, what's funny and what's not. And I think that question is very important. What is funny? You know, and comedy is, you know, to take subjects that are easy to laugh at, it's unsatisfying. But to find subjects that you shouldn't be laughing at and find a way to make those subjects funny without exploiting the tragedy of it somehow, but being aware of it, acknowledging it, that's a great challenge. And most of the comedy that I've been involved with is looking and trying and attempting to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, I feel like those Native American comics that you spoke to, I think was in episode 3, that really kind of hits that point home. Like, just the way that they're able to balance the tragedy of their, you know, where they come from with funny. And it's very legitimately funny stuff.
It is, and you're right. It is a tough road for almost all the comedians that I spoke to around the world, and right here in America, as you point out. To be oppressed people, to be minorities, to be outsiders or fringe or marginalized in the society, and still wanting to express yourself and find that commonality with a larger mass, that's a tremendous challenge in all these countries, really. And the three women from the Ladies of Native Comedy, they were fantastic. They're funny, and they're very, very smart and insightful about this process.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of goes back to what you said about being a kid in Brooklyn, about this idea of it's a tool for survival, being funny. It's just, you know?
Yes. And by the way, I didn't go into this project thinking, oh, it's going to be a tool for survival or it's going to be a tool of healing. I was thinking I'll see people, you know, making satire about their governments and taking those chances. And there was a lot of that. And it was great, but there was also a lot of comedy as a survival tool and a lot of comedy as a healing tool in places where war is present, where suffering is present. Comedy takes on the role of healing, almost like church does in a lot of places. People come to the comedy shows to laugh and just relax and lighten their load for a minute, lighten that burden for a minute. And I saw the power of that. And I respected that deeply. And you don't see that quite as much in a country without those stakes like America.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of finish up, I noticed you point out in one of the episodes, too, that you actually grew up in Trump apartments in Brooklyn, which is, I don't know if that's irony or what exactly that is, but What was that like? It was actually Fred Trump, right? Not Donald, his father?
Yeah, it was Fred Trump. Fred Trump and a few other guys in New York at that time sort of took advantage of these housing laws to build these gigantic housing projects. And they were all over the city in all the boroughs. And the one I lived in was called Trump Village. And it was very Soviet-like. It was nice. And I was a kid, and it was new. But it was, you know, in looking back on it, it's still there, of course. It's very Soviet-like. In fact, I think it's mostly Russian now, in fact, ironically, because it's in Brighton Beach.
Right.
And you know, it was 20 apartments on a floor, 23-story buildings, 7 buildings, and everybody moved in at the same time, you know? Mm-hmm. So there were cool things about that. Our demographics, I mean, I had hundreds of friends because there was just so many kids that moved in at the same time, but it was also a kind of a Lord of the Flies-like environment eventually, where it was very survival of the fittest. And if you didn't play sports and you didn't fit in and you didn't have something, some skill to keep you above the fray, you'd be swallowed up in it.
Yeah. Did Donald ever swing by and make a cameo?
He did. I remember we had... We christened the Little League field. They built a very makeshift Little League field under the train, actually, under the D train. And at the christening of the field, Fred and Donald accompanied Fred. And he was probably, you know, he's 10 years older than me, 12 years older than me or something. So he was still a young guy himself, but he already had the haircut, you know. So... He was already practicing that.
Well, thank you so much for just telling us all about your life and, you know, your comedy and your new show. It's just so much to explore.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for being curious, and I really appreciated it and enjoyed it.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of the show and our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks.